Summit is Dr. Timothy Sheckley. Dr. Sheckley is a communications technology expert, a PhD with an environmental, or rather an international consultant in computer engineering and standardization, a former faculty member at the University of Colorado's Engineering College, and a senior research fellow at the National Institute for Science, Law, and Public Policy. Dr. Sheckley's works, Getting Smarter About the Smart Grid and Reinventing Wires, the Future of Landline and Networks, are uniquely positioned to help provide a roadmap for real solutions to the problems associated with the hasty and untested deployment of 5G and small cells. Dr. Sheckley, thank you so much for being with us on the 5G and Beyond Summit today.
Thank you, Josh. It's a pleasure.
So, Dr. Sheckley, just what is 5G and what are its stated intentions or stated objectives?
Well, 5G is means the fifth generation cellular telephone network. Roughly speaking, every 10 years, the industry has come up with a new generation of cellular phones, and this is the one that's being introduced now. It's not ready yet. It's really in its earliest stage and prototype, essentially. It's being tested in a couple of cities, but there's really no such thing yet. It's the technical standards aren't finished, and the spectrum hasn't been allocated yet.
Okay. And what's the claimed benefits of 5G? How is the industry, you know, pushing this through and getting the support?
Well, the goal is that, as the industry states, is to have have higher speed connection and lower latency or less delay in the message response, so that when you push a button, there's a certain delay, and what they want to do is cut that down, minimize it, and they have promised a lot of new applications that range from being able to use this for the Internet of Things, whatever that is, the autonomous vehicles, our virtual reality, I think inevitably it's going to be faster video and particularly more ads.
Okay, so what are there other perhaps, you know, hidden real reasons that are maybe different than what we're being sold? What are the real reasons of 5G if they're different than what you just said?
Well, I think if you look underneath all of this, you find that they need to sell more phones, they need to sell more chips, and they want to collect more data. That's what the industry is really about. And if you look at the statistics on the sale of smartphones, it's really backed off in the last couple of years very dramatically. Even Apple Computer has made a huge amount of money on this. Is seeing a decline, a two-year now decline in sales, particularly in the developed world. And they need a new generation to get people to buy a new phone. And if you know, that's basically the bottom line. You have to buy a new. You have to buy a new phone, build more chips, and find new ways to get consumers to more addicted to this service.
Yeah, so it's money, control, and profit, and data, of course.
They promise all these applications I mentioned, but really it boils down to advertising is the primary function of the whole network. It's delivering ads to you and pinpointing you and targeting you and collecting data on you so that those ads can be better targeted. And that's what 5G is going to be about too.
So in addition to data and ad, you know, data collecting and advertising, you know, more directly, I guess, with more granular data, what are your concerns about 5G and about the direction that the wireless industry is going?
Well, there's a number of concerns. For one thing, 5G and 4G are kind of wedded together in a way that isn't true of the earlier generations, because 5G doesn't even promise to do voice service. So to have a smartphone that has voice communication, you need to have, it'll have to be both. In fact, the 4G will be used, 4G LTE it's called, long-term evolution, which means 10 years, is about coordinating the 5G, and the 5G will be the actual high-speed download, data download part, and it'll be managed by the 4G. So there's another important factor, though, is the 5G uses a whole different, or will use, or is promised to use, a whole new frequency range that's very new and never been used for this before, or for much at all, and has unknown characteristics. And that's the what they call millimeter wave, which are in gigahertz. The range and propagation characteristics are so different from the frequencies presently being used, down around 1 gigahertz or under 1 gigahertz to 900 megahertz. The 5G frequencies will be way up into the maybe 20, 30 gigahertz, and they will be a much shorter range. Instead of a 3 to 5 mile range, they'll have only a few hundred feet maybe. And so they, as a result, they will have to put in more cell towers or cell sites. So they came up with this idea of the small cell, which is the idea of putting a cellular transmitter or transceiver in every in lampposts, maybe as close as 100 feet or less, down this, in every neighborhood, to saturate basically the entire environment with these millimeter wave frequencies in order to get adequate coverage for people and for any, certainly for any devices in your, or vehicles or moving objects. So that is a different, what is much different about it. In order to do that, then they had, they couldn't afford to license all those cell towers if they had to go pay for it. So what they did is they got laws passed in all and about at least half the states almost, and to preempt local regulations, so that the industry was able to get the, will be able to get access to these, to the public rights of way, to put these things on every street, every lamppost, or wherever they want, and the park benches, anything, buildings, without having to really pay the full cost and externalize that cost onto the community.
Are these the ALEC laws that you speak of, or are these, is it a different set of legislation?
Oh, yeah. There were really two strategies. One was to get the ALEC organization, which creates model legislation, they put forth model legislation, and I think it was adopted in over 20 states so far, to enable this, to preempt local regulation.
And that's the American Legislative Exchange Council, correct?
Right, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a libertarian think tank that that creates model legislation on many, many topics, but this is one of them. And then, as a backup for that, they got the Federal Communications Commission to promulgate the same set of rules at the national level to preempt local regulation. And because the chair of the Federal Communications Commission is a guy from Verizon, so that's their agenda. So that is being challenged in court, and these laws are being challenged. Everything's being challenged right now. It's up in the air, because when people finally woke up to the fact that this was happening, or starting to happen, there's been quite an uproar that has emerged. And then there's a whole different dimension to it, aside from the preemption of local, the rights of local communities to regulate the health, safety, and environmental quality, is this issue of big questions around electromagnetic radiation. And we know that existing cell phones create, there's a potential hazard there, because that research has just come forward in the last couple of years, it's been around a long time, but some recent research has really reinforced that. And then those concerns. And then there's the added fact that the 5G is even yet in a newer, also employs not just the old frequencies, but new frequencies too, that are completely a mystery as to how they behave and what they do. And the biological effects of all that and health effects is completely unknown. So it's a mass experiment on a huge population that was that's being put forward here.
What's your take on earlier in 2019, Senator Blumenthal was grilling reps from the, you know, senior representatives from the wireless industry, who basically admitted in that Senate hearing that they haven't done any testing on the health effects of 5G frequencies, and they don't plan to. There's no budget. They don't plan to assign a budget, and they're proceeding anyway. What's your thoughts on that, and like, how did things kind of get to that point?
Well, in the past, everyone has deferred to the FCC emissions limits, but the problem is those are so far out of date, decades out of date, and they were based on old, you know, issues around radar and microwaves and heating of tissue. But in recent years, there's been a huge body of evidence that it's not the thermal effects or the heating effects that are important, that there are other effects that that have to do with non-thermal effects of non-ionizing radiation effects that may create a health hazard. So, but the FCC has absolutely no capability or even interest in studying medical issues or biological issues or epidemiological issues. They're not equipped to do that and don't plan to. So the FCC is kind of like lost in the woods here, and they don't really know what to do, and they don't have any staff to deal with it. So it's a big question, and the industry's trying to sweep it under the rug.
So there's the you know, data harvesting, the mass increase in data harvesting that the 5G plan is really associated with. There's the health and environmental effects that we don't really know about, but they're proceeding without having those tests. Meanwhile, the independent testing is indicating there's a very likely a problem. And then there's the passing of laws that you mentioned, both at the federal level, the FCC, and at the state level with the ALEC laws. You quoted in your recent your paper, Reinventing Wires, you said the internet has become one of the defining technologies of our society. It is our central medium for commerce and communication, and more importantly for our public discourse, engagement, and democratic governance. However, it has been hijacked by the commercial motivations that have come to redefine and constrain the availability, quality, content, and media of high-speed access in the United States. What's the danger? What's the pathway that we need to be aware of and you know, maybe take action on of this hijacking? Like what can you just kind of paint a picture for us with your decades of experience and leadership within the communications industry? This being hijacked by commercial interests that seem to be just passing laws and seem to be just going ahead even without any testing. What are the dangers of that? What are we looking at?
Well, the original concept behind the internet was something much different than what we have today. And believe it or not, there was a time in about 1995 that it was completely non-commercial. And there was a debate at the time about whether it should be commercialized or not, or whether commercial activity and advertising should be allowed on the internet. And then the government at the time decided to just basically privatize the whole thing and let it go. It was a government-owned and operated network. And we've seen it evolve now, and we've seen, you know, it's almost hard to imagine people, kids growing up today with their smartphones that wouldn't have any inkling that that was ever true. What I mean by hijacking is that by far the primary business model of the internet is advertising, and that's far from the original concept. It was communication And I don't know what can be done about that, or anything that could be done about it. But there's some really excellent books coming out now. People, scholars are looking at this, like books like the Antisocial Media is one of them. Another one I just got myself here is a book by Harvard Law professor called Surveillance Capitalism. It's about the concept of that this business model, what it's morphed into, this Frankenstein machine that has taken over, and these gargantuan corporations that have an unbelievable political power and wealth is reshaping our whole society. And, you know, here again, I'm not sure what to do about it, but one thing is that one element that I've addressed is that it's creating this disparity between the rich and the poor, the people that have access and the people that don't. And my feeling is that they all ought to have access, and it ought to be basic access, not based on access to wireless phone industry, but basic access through optical fiber networks to every community. At least it evens the playing field a little bit, and it's not so as intensive, focused on the commercial purposes, but some of the other purposes that are more important to cities and towns can be incorporated into it.
Hmm. You mentioned a triopoly instead of a monopoly, and what's happening. So this, as we know, it's this 5G deployment and planning is happening worldwide, but in the United States, you talk about a triopoly. Can you just share with us your perspective on that? Why? What is the triopoly, and what are the threats of having such a thing in place?
Yeah, I think you make a good point that it's different in the United States and everywhere else. But one difference is the completely privatized system we have here. And virtually everything, from electric power to communications. But the triopoly is essentially back in the mid 80s, we divested the telephone system, the Ma Bell system, because it was a monopoly, and it had prevented technical innovation and it preserved high prices. It also preserved, high standards of performance. But more importantly, it prevented innovation. So that was the ideal. There was to break up that monopoly and get innovation back in the system. Well, that worked. But unfortunately, what has happened since then, and particularly with the Telecom Act of 1996, the restructuring of that, in the name of innovation, they completely unleashed wireless, and they at the same time throttle back the wired networks that exist, the old networks, and any kind of even new networks that were wired or hardwired. Like at the time was a copper-based network, copper wires, and now it's all of it's based on optical fiber, but the fiber going to your house is regulated differently than the fiber going to your, than the wireless services you get. So wireless basically got a free ride, and so all the telecom companies converted themselves into wireless companies. And my book, Reinventing Wires, talks in some detail about how all that happened, what the sequence of events was. But basically, it restructured the industry in a completely unfettered, unregulated capitalism that resulted in reconsolidating the Bell companies more than to create a new triopoly that is even more powerful than the old Bell monopoly. And the triopoly is Verizon, AT&T, which are really the remnants of the telephone net, the Ma Bell system, plus the cable industry. And it's all morphed into one huge triopoly that dominates internet access in this country and maintains artificially high prices, poor service, and constrains any kind of innovation.
I wanted to ask, where do you see this whole driverless car, you know, aspect of 5G going? It seems like an incredibly ambitious initiative to have driverless cars controlled by wireless, you know, signals and radiation. And I know I've already seen like news reports about crashes and things go wrong. How do you see this whole thing unfolding?
Well, I'm very skeptical about it. There's two aspects. One is the driverless car itself, or the autonomous vehicle, and then the other is the use of 5G. There's a fundamental problem, and the idea of the if you look at it sounds nice to talk about a autonomous vehicle, but if you really think about it, why do you want one? What is it for? What is it good for? And is it just another way to, is industry creating this because it's a fad and that's another way to sell integrated circuits and cram electronics into cars and to collect data on people that can be monetized in one way or another, or collect data on whatever. Is that what it's really about? Why do we need an autonomous vehicle? People like to drive their cars. You can come up with scenarios where they can sit back and read a newspaper and get ferried around. Sure, there are a certain number of people that might like that, but I don't think it's a market. I think it might be a fleet market. I don't see it as people. And then the technical challenges around it are incredibly huge. It requires precise mapping of every square inch, basically, where the car might go, and keeping it current. Not just mapping it, but keeping it current, because the car can't drive down a road that's been, you know, that's where the bridge has been removed, you know, and the car not know that. So, but the economics of it don't make any sense to me. Who's going to buy these cars? And why would someone buy them? You hear them about Uber all the time. Uber, oh, they're going to move to self-driving cars. But the basic business model of Uber is not about the basic business model of Uber. Uber is about externalizing the cost of the labor and the car onto the labor force. It's basically a labor for taking advantage of a labor force, what they call the sharecropper model of labor. Was post-slavery. In other words, it's even worse than slavery, because the workers have to not only feed themselves and pay their car insurance to maintain their car, and then they chisel down the workers to the absolute minimum that they'll stand before they quit. And that's the business model of Uber. So the benefit to Uber was they didn't have to buy the cars and they didn't have to maintain them. And if they go to autonomous vehicles, they would have to do both of those things. They wouldn't have the benefit of the labor shouldering the costs of their fleet. So why in the world would they do it? Well, it's hype. It sounds good to the stock market. It's about selling stock.
Castles in the air.
It's about selling stock to the stock market and going public like they just did. So, and people are getting a little bit antsy about that, because look at what happened with their stock offering price. Same thing with Lyft. Okay, well, translate that into the issue of the autonomous vehicle market overall. I think that Google really started this by frightening General Motors and all the other car manufacturers and Toyota and everybody into thinking that they had to, the car of the future was going to be about electronics crammed in a car. And they all had to get on that bandwagon, or they were going to be left behind. And they didn't understand that bandwagon. Google did. and the Silicon Valley guys understood, they understand selling chips and software and apps. They know how to do that, and so they frightened the car industry into joining their club, into their bandwagon. And it's like a giant Ponzi scheme, you know, that they keep upping the ante, and so now everybody's on this quest for the autonomous car, autonomous vehicle, but nobody really knows what it's needed for.
Yeah, exactly. So, 5G, autonomous vehicles, Internet of Things, potentially Internet of People, the way this is, the corporations are seeing this, and then AI, right?
It's mostly hype, and AI is a similar thing. AI is just another word. It's old wine in new bottles, you know. It's like the same story. We've had that term AI around since I started in this business, which was in the 1970s when I got interested in computers. It was about what we called AI at the time, I guess. But AI today is something is a buzzword. It's a way of hyping stock, and it is computers. It's making computers and algorithms that run in computers. It's nothing new about. There is some new stuff, I should say, that the neural network is really the cutting edge of AI. But that's a whole discussion in itself where that may or may not go.
It seems like this could be really, I'm starting to see this whole thing could be the next bubble burst.
Yeah, mostly that's what I think it is. It's a bubble, and it's mainly about investment in the stock market and positioning startup companies for stock offerings and at some point in the future, and Silicon Valley hyping its wares to the rest of the world. And I think there's a skepticism that has just emerged in the last year, in the last few months more. If you look at it, the people are starting to wise up a little bit about Silicon Valley and the big corporations like Google, Facebook, and Amazon, and Apple even. Apple is probably the least onerous or the least of those offensive of those that I named, but the least that CEO of Apple has tried to give has some misgivings about all this, and he's written those down. But the other guys are just getting the money, and Zuckerberg is the epitome of the go get the money, just get the money and tell them whatever they want to hear.
So your papers, both of these significant works that you've done, first the Getting Smarter About the Smart Grid and Reinventing Wires, they get into actual solutions, and you were touching on them there with wired networks, and help us to understand, like, because I think there's a perspective that wired networks and landlines and are sort of antiquated or somehow no longer useful, but there was correct me if I'm wrong, but in the early 2000s, there was a huge investment and there was a build-out that was starting with fiber optics, with wired, high-speed wired networks that was sort of hijacked as well, right? So help us understand, what are some of the major discoveries and ideas that you are helping us to, helping the world really solve this problem with 5G within your published work?
Well, I call it reinventing wires because the wires, when I say wires, I mean both copper cables, particularly Ethernet is the technology we all use on copper, mostly. But we have the old telephone DSL networks and stuff like that. And then the other thing is fiber. An optical fiber has come to be the dominant means of the sending information, even for cellular networks. There's this illusion, I think, that people have that their cell phone is somehow talking to the cloud, directly. and that they don't really know how it works. It just works, and they don't realize that cell phone is only going the last 100 feet or the last mile, if you will, or the last maybe maximum of 5 miles to a cell site that is then connected by optical fiber to a global network, and that's how it works. And what I'm advocating simply is, the bottleneck in that system is the wireless part. But there's one thing about wireless that is so handy. Wireless is good for things that move. And so if you're going to move, it's very handy. But otherwise, if you're not moving, then you get far better performance and better service by having a wire. And so that instead of just running those fibers to everybody's cells, to all these cell sites, let's make sure those fibers go to everybody's house and they're everybody's business. And then it'll be a fair comparison. So there's a movement that Triopoly has constrained the development, and they've diverted all that fiber construction to their cell sites. There's some huge lawsuits now over that because they've expropriated billions of dollars that should have got their ratepayers paid for their phone service that should have gone to upgrade their service and did not. It went to upgrade the cell sites. And so what I'm calling for is a new movement that's well underway for every town and city and community in the country to build out their own fiber as they would their own sewer system, their water system, and their streets. And they need fiber to everybody as well, because it's a necessity of modern life to be able, you can't file job applications, you can't get any public documents without it. So why should we be dependent on a proprietary wireless network to do that? Because the fiber networks are not proprietary.
Talk more about the benefits that will be gained by doing that, by wiring to the building level.
Well, one of the benefits that of course, everybody would be able to get this high performance access in their home, and then they would be, you could work at home because you could have a server, you have symmetrical servers with fiber. You can upload stuff just as fast as you download it. So conventional older systems of DSL and cable systems don't provide that kind of symmetry, and the mobile systems don't either. They're built for downloading ads and downloading movies and things like that. They're not built for symmetrical service. So the nice thing about fiber would be that you could have a server in your house and you could run a business out of it, and your business would work better. And the other factor is that there's a lot of automation coming, particularly let's take the example of energy. Energy management is an area that I work in a lot, and that has to do with distributed solar and storage. We could convert our entire energy system off of coal and fossil fuels to solar energy and with storage batteries, but it becomes very important to be able to control the flow of electricity in the local community in real time, basically, and trade that power back and forth to optimize the performance of a distributed system like that. And microgrids, we call solar microgrids, but they need high-speed communication to work, and optical fiber would be ideal. And interestingly enough, a lot of the fiber systems have been installed around the country, and particularly our neighbor next door here, Longmont, Colorado, has the electric company, which is owned by the community, has also installed optical fiber to every customer, and so the customers can get not only electricity, but they can also get internet, the people that they've got over 55% subscription rate to that, and those customers can get gigabit internet access, symmetrical service for $49 a month. It's just you can't beat that. That's like having a modern you know, having indoor plumbing, right?
Yeah. So, and you talk about in your previous paper, getting smart about the smart grid, the solutions that you bring forward, you've termed, instead of a smart grid, it's a wise grid, right? Can you talk a little bit more about that? And in particular, include, if you could, the metering side of things. What kind of meters, utility meters, would we need to have, would you recommend to make this, you know, locally controlled, solar integrated, new energy technology integrated wise grid most effective?
Yeah, well, that's sort of what I was just talking about a little bit. If you have a power grid that is in a parallel fiber optic network that is links everything together, you can do it's not just metering that you need to do, but you need to control the flow of energy. In other words, every building needs to have some kind of intelligent hub or gateway that controls the flow of energy within the home and balances the generation, use, and storage of energy on the premises, and then communicates with neighboring premises through the local distribution grid and the fiber network to balance that flow within the community. And you can achieve, the whole community can achieve overall extremely high levels of penetration of solar energy by doing that.
Without smart meters, though, right?
Well, the metering is kind of an interesting problem, because originally the meters were for the purpose of regulating controlling the use of energy on the premises, and then maybe once a month they would be read by a utility company. But they got the cart in front of the horse, and the utility industry discovered they could make a lot of money on the smart meter network by installing a completely redundant wireless communication network. And it didn't need to be wireless. It made more sense in the original prototypes of those meters that were developed back in the mid-90s, early 90s, were really hardwired through the telephone network. But they discovered they could make more money by selling an extra network, and it was a wireless network, and it's really about the money, because the utility industry makes money off of capital return on the capital assets. So the meters become a big money machine, when in fact the meter really ought to be part of a home control system that is working entirely on the premises, and then could possibly send billing data once a month to a utility. But it doesn't make sense the way it's set up now, where the utility has to suck out the data on a 15-minute interval basis, which it doesn't have any idea what to do with, and then send you a monthly bill. And then sell the data to somebody else for some other entirely different purpose. It doesn't make any sense. So what I'm trying to do is get this back to what the original concept of the smart meter was, as part of a system that's on for premises control of energy, premises-based control. Somehow the illusion was used to sell the smart meter idea that there was going to be some giant computer in the sky that knew that could monitor everybody's toaster and somehow control a flow of energy, which it cannot do, and they have no interest in doing that.
So in your the solutions that you've mapped out, is a digital meter still required to do that home level of control, or can it be an analog meter with the appropriate technology that doesn't suck data out, as you put it?
Well, people want the analog meters because they don't have radios in them. They're not radiating microwaves. You don't have to have a microwave transmitter on your house. In fact, if you were the modern equipment has meters built into it, like a solar inverter. It's measuring the amount of power that's being produced and that's coming off the solar panels and the amount of power that's going into the house. And you can, you know, there's nothing wrong with doing that if you're using that information locally to you know, to control the flow of energy. A digital meter is just fine because it's not a radio. The issue here is the radio transmitter, turning it into a microwave transmitter, a radar transmitter. Why do we need that? That we don't. It's completely useless and redundant and counterproductive.
So we know that smart meters were installed to, you know, surveil people and collect data, and they don't even know how to really use it, but in most cases, although some, it's being monetized, and you don't know who it's going to. We know that, you know, you said earlier, we talked about 5G, basically very, very similar thing, data harvesting, control, profit, you know, in the name of convenience. So my question is this, is what is your understanding of how smart utility meters and 5G infrastructure are planned to work together, or are they not planned to work together?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I would assume that they'll, you know, try to milk that cash cow too. You know, the utility industry, you know, they need to make money. So if they can make money off of it, they'll do it. And and get the regulators to let them get away with it. But the data doesn't need to leave the premises. The data is needed on the premises. In fact, the premises needs data from the network, from the power company. It's not vice versa. The power company doesn't need data from the premises. The premises needs the data from the power company about the price of energy at any particular time or demand, what they call demand charges, demand response issues. The flow of data, they have it backwards right now. That's what, if you need any data, that's what it would be needed for. And I think that the idea behind using a fiber network to control the flow of energy is actually one of the cutting edge areas right now. The Department of Energy has a technology called transactive energy, which is the idea of real time local trading of energy on a, you know, like short 5-minute interval basis between homes and buildings in a distribution grid. That could be done, and it could be make that distribution grid very efficient, and nobody needs to collect that data and sell it. It's data that's just held on the premises and minimized. There's no need to send data off into the electric company or into the larger grid. It's something for local grid management.
Yeah. So in your Wise Grids solution, can you tell us about help us to get an understanding for the level of effectiveness of solar energy production and energy storage. You know, where is it at right now, and where is it developing to? Like, is it viable in terms of large scale transition technology?
Well, we've seen huge changes in the last 2 years. In terms of the price of solar panels and the price of solar energy. And also we've seen not quite as far along yet, but it's getting there too. It's changing just at the same rate is the battery storage and the technology behind that. Well, the solar panels are already competitive with any other kind of electricity. Wind and solar are we're seeing proposals around here for, you know, just buying solar power from large wind farms and large solar installations down in the 1 or 2 cents per kilowatt hour range, which is unbelievable when, you know, coal and other, you know, conventional sources are up in the, you know, several cents, up to 8-10 cents in some places, or more per kilowatt hour. So it's already, solar is already competitive with any other source of energy. the issue around solar, of course, is storage. And so if you pair solar storage with solar, then you've got the perfect solution. The storage is still very expensive, and the performance is improves dramatically in the last couple of years, and it will continue to improve because they use the same kind of battery technology in electric vehicles, and there's a huge effort going on there all over the world to improve that. So the economies of vehicle battery storage will also accrue to the users of stationary batteries in homes and buildings and even in local grid operations. So it's competitive at this point with solar and storage are competitive with natural gas and far better than coal at the present time. So
what would you say about, I live close to Seattle, and so what would you say about this, you know, we don't get 300 days of sun like you do in Boulder. So how viable would that be in cloudier climates?
Well, one thing about Seattle, you do have a lot of hydro, and that's how, that's one other aspect of it too, because that, you know, can be made to work together with the same electric power grid, although most of that hydro is larger scale hydro. I tend to feel that the smaller distributed technologies are going to be better than highly centralized ones, but then you do have that, you already have all that hydro, so there it is. The and there's a lot of wind available too in that part of the country. But to answer your question about the solar, it just takes more of it if it's not so sunny. Here in the Denver area, we have an average of 300 sunny days a year. You don't have that many in Seattle, so you need more solar. But in Germany has gotten a reputation for being one of the most solarized countries in the world already, and they're certainly not any sunnier than Seattle. So it can be done. It just takes more of it.
Have you had a chance to look into, okay, so with like wind production and to a lesser extent with solar as well, the technology by default, it seems to be basically as such that it produces either magnetic fields and or dirty electricity, voltage transients and so forth. Have you had a chance to look into any technologies to mitigate or to make safer solar and especially wind, I would suppose, in terms of that concern that people have?
Well, the technology is available to do that. It's just that it costs a certain amount, and the people that build that equipment, if they don't care about it, they're not going to build it in. The new inverters that we have, the new inverters for homes, the smaller inverters can be extremely clean. They don't generate any dirty electricity. They actually clean up the electricity. Some of the older equipment is pretty noisy. You know, basically what you call dirty electricity is electrical noise that's created by sloppy, cheap electronics. And if you take care to design the electronics properly, like some of the manufacturers have done, it's very nice. It's very clean. And, the same thing can be said about, you know, LED lamps and compact fluorescent lamps. They tend to have real cheap, sloppy power supplies, badly designed because the people designing them didn't care. If people care, then they can get the stuff that is properly designed. The big windmills, same story. The electrical problems around those, are significant, but they can be mitigated with the proper designs. I don't tend to be a fan of wind farms, big wind farms, because they require transmission. That means building transmission systems, and those create all kinds of radiation and noise and cost a lot of money. It's capital intensive. I think that we're seeing an opportunity here that to change. To morph the electric system from a 100-year-old centralized, a capital-intensive structure to a new decentralized, distributed consumer electronic mass market structure. And those kinds of products can be designed to be user-friendly.
And so by communities and local governments and, you know, individuals getting behind this kind of technology, not only are we, you know, like literally bringing our power back into our own hands and out of the hands of multinational corporate interests, but we're preserving this, like you said, this surveillance economy, right? We're preserving our rights from being kind of taken over by, let's say, a surveillance economy on the back of a, you know, smart grid, 5G network, Internet of Things.
Yeah, here again, I agree completely with that. And that my philosophy is basically around, you know, smaller sometimes is better, or usually better, because it doesn't entail these institutional structures and capital structures that are so politically, uncontrollable. If we can favor localized governance and localized distributed technologies, then we'll be much better able to shape our environment in a desirable way. When stuff is controlled by big corporations, you don't get any say over what they do or what they design. And if you're, smaller, markets work better. When any market gets too big, it becomes out of control and dominated by corporate interests.
So I'm going to maybe put you on the spot a little bit and ask your specific preferences around some technologies in just a moment. But you were talking about it is possible, if there's a motivation to do so, to clean up dirty power or voltage transients from, you know, wind production, from solar production. Like, that technology is available. It just needs to be an awareness brought to that market and the producers, and then it can be cleaned up. We actually have someone in the summit, Terry Stodden, and our audience will be very interested in a specific technology that he's developed and he's had in place for quite a long time that are getting specific, very positive results with reducing dirty power and also reducing people's bills, people's utility bills. So my question is, with regards to storage or energy production, are there specific, you know, a year or two ago we were hearing a lot about Tesla's Powerwall as being, you know, the new market, cream of the crop for the commonly known and available product for storage energy. Is that a product that you would recommend? Are there more advanced products out there now? What are you most excited about in terms of energy storage? And perhaps if you want to talk about like specific energy production, specific brands, and feel free to name like specific brands or companies.
Okay, well, that's an interesting question, and relating back to the issue of clean power and dirty power, there is a real opportunity with this kind of distributed architecture, storage, and small inverters, and, you know, like home level equipment, to go to DC power I think a market would be developed for a transition to more DC appliances, which is the cleanest kind of power. So, people don't realize it, but if you buy a new dishwasher or appliance, some kind of major appliance, it already has DC motors in it. It's DC powered inside. They just run it off the AC power system because that's what's available. But if the market were to develop for DC, and it was commonly available, then they would cut a lot of cost out of major appliances by they're already using DC motors inside. They just wouldn't have to do that conversion, and the cost would go way down. The other aspect, I think, is that with a DC, the solar system is inherently a DC coupled system, the solar plus storage that I'm talking about, because one problem with the Powerwall, I thought, was that it was in a lot of these there's kind of a debate going on in this battery industry and inverter industry over whether we're going to use high voltage batteries or low voltage batteries. The ideal from my, I tend to favor the low voltage. A 48 volt battery system is a standard that's been around for many years. I mean, that was pioneered by Thomas Edison, the idea of not going over 50 volts in a power grid, and he really developed a lot of the battery technology that's even now finally coming to market. The but the Powerwall is my understanding is that it's for efficiency reasons, and it's running at a much higher voltage because the solar systems, it's cheaper to wire them up so that they produce high voltage DC. But the problem is that's extremely dangerous, and it creates a system that's not consumer friendly, and then you're not going to go messing around inside a power wall because it's extremely dangerous to work in those voltages, particularly with DC. But 48 volts, I mean, you can go buy 48 volt batteries anywhere and put them in, and consumers can do that. It's something quite accessible to consumers, and the new inverters that serve those companies like Outback and Snyder Electric and Magnum, those all make basically low voltage DC systems that they still work with solar panels fine, but they convert the high voltage DC into low voltage battery power, and then they work with that in the premises. So then you have a DC power bus that's available, and there are new products coming out for lighting, for instance, lighting control, lighting systems that are low voltage DC. And all of the appliances you're using, your phones and your computers and everything's running on low voltage DC. I mean, that's what they work on. And so you put a power supply in the wall, it's 110 volt power supply, it's converting everything to low voltage DC. So the new standards that I talk about in my paper for building wiring using Ethernet, where you can transmit data around a building at the same speed as the fiber coming in at gigabit per second, if you want to, that copper is able to do that. And not only that, but the copper, the new versions of Ethernet that are coming out now in the standards committees that I work in, we're working on that right now. The technical standards to support that are new versions of USB that will that include Ethernet and will deliver DC power over the same wire. So the wire, you can have a wire going around, wires in your house that deliver not only gigabit DC, gigabit in data, but also power. So it's basically data over, instead of data over power, it's power over data. Power lines. So you can plug your smartphone into a wire to charge it on the wall, and it would get both data and power to charge the battery out of the same plug. A new version of USB.
So if it's power over data rather than data over power, such as the what is it called? Not power wall, but those technologies where you run internet through the electricity lines in your house. I've tested that, and that creates terrible dirty electricity, terrible voltage transit.
That's been around different versions of that for years and years, and I've worked with it a lot, and that's not the solution, but the new one is the way to go. It's the power over data.
So there's no dirty electricity problems or voltage transients in that solution, right?
No, it's completely shielded and works fine. It's delivering DC.
Okay. I also want to say, as a transition technology, I don't know if you've heard of MOCA, M-O-C-A, Multimedia Over Coaxial Alliance. So there's, and people on Amazon, people watching this can go on Amazon and look this up, M-O-C-A, and then the number 2, so MOCA 2. I've actually set this up in about 4 homes, and it's basically, have you heard of it, first of all?
Well, I've heard the name, but I confess that I'm not up to speed on Mocha.
Well, what you're doing is you know the real solution, and so this is a transition technology that actually has an adapter between your wired router and the cable, the TV cable system throughout your house. So the TV cable wiring and throughout your house, so it actually allows the internet to be transmitted and available in every room that has a TV cable outlet. So that's actually in this house, and I've set up a number of houses. So that is a very viable transition technology that I would definitely recommend. But so I want to get back to the 5G problem and your wired solutions. So the question is this, it appears to me, Tim, that this is kind of a battle between local governments and the people needing to actually team up with their local governments to preserve local rights, to preserve even, you know, individual rights like we're talking about with these locally controlled, home controlled technologies, and you know, against, you could say, the FCC or big corporate interests that are controlling the FCC. So when this was first announced, or I don't know, first announced, but earlier this year, I think, it was reported that more than 300 local governments across the United States were threatening legal action against the FCC. Because we're going to have people sharing this with local government reps, and there's going to be local elected officials watching, what would you say to local governments that are really at that place of saying, you know, I see the value in this, I see the importance of this conversation, but really I'm not sure about this legal battle. I'm not sure about, you know, going against big corporate interests or the FCC. What would you say to maybe encourage local government officials that are in that process of you know, figuring out the best way forward?
Well, I'd say, you know, you have to stand up to them. They have to get some courage and realize that they're there to represent their constituents. They're there to represent the people that live in their community. That's their job. And if they can't do that, they need to step aside and let someone else do it. But the rather than say, oh, our hands are tied by the federal laws or the FCC or the even state laws, get them changed. You have to change. You have to fight to change this, because you've got to, as you might use the phrase, take back your power. You know, you've got to take it back, and that's not, may not be easy, and people may have to do a lot of work to make that happen. But all, at the end of the day, all political power is local, starts out being local, it's at the city council level, it's at the county level, and if democracy doesn't work at that level, then it's not going to work anywhere. It has to start there, and you have to fight with every tool you can find. There are all these cities and towns have bound together. There are statewide organizations of cities and towns that can represent the interests of those. And their charge is the public right of way. They control, the local governments control the right of way, and it's their responsibility to protect the health, safety, and environment of the people that live there, that they represent. So that's where you have to start. It requires a lot of lobbying to change state laws back to what they were, undo these ALEC laws that got done, you know, while we were all sleeping or looking the other way. Fight the FCC, the Natural Resources Defense Council, I think, filed one of the suits there, and I know that many municipalities joined that suit through their organizations, like in Colorado, is the Colorado Communications and Utilities Alliance, represents many, many towns and cities in Colorado, and they joined the lawsuit with the NRDC. So that is going forward. I don't know the status of it right now, but that's basically to undo what the FCC has done. And there's also laws being brought forward in Congress. If people, raise this issue with their representatives, we'll see if democracy really works. But what else have we got?
It's kind of it's on trial right now. Democracy is on trial, right?
Absolutely. And so, this is a test, and the corporation as an institution that is at the root of all this is the way we've allowed that the corporation to become the Frankenstein invention of humanity is the corporation. It is the machine that's out of control. It's a very efficient, effective technology, the corporation, that form of organizing human activity, but it's completely out of control, and it was allowed to go out of control. And there are things that are being proposed now to bring it back under control. Everything from antitrust enforcement, a great book now by Tim Wu. I don't know if you've heard of that, but he talks about revitalizing the antitrust law, enforcement of antitrust law. There's a big editorial in the Wall Street, and I'm sorry, in the New York Times just last week by the co-founder of Facebook, saying they ought to break it up. And that is exactly what Wu was talking about. So we need to get the people elected that will make that happen. And and there are many other aspects of corporate governance. The corporations, I think it can be salvaged, but it needs some work. There's a thing called a B Corp, that we could move to. It's a nascent movement, mostly breweries that I know of, but it's an effective way of making a more benign corporation. There are things that can be done. I think it just takes local action to start with.
Local action and political will, right? How in this context, how important is it that the people communicate and educate their elected officials in this?
Well, it's vitally important because the elected officials, they're really swamped with issues.
Yes.
All the time. I know some of the members of the city council here, and they have hundreds of pages of stuff they have to read. They don't get paid very much, if any. They don't have any staff, and they have to make the decisions. And this, what ends up happening is that the counties and state and city governments end up being controlled by the bureaucrats, the managers, and the elected officials are so strapped for time. So anything you can do to make it easier for your legislators, for your elected officials, to get up to speed on things and help them, anything you can do, they appreciate. And of course they're swamped, and the old saying, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. So you have to be the squeaky wheel if you want to get their attention.
So we're advocating for people to do a simple action along with thousands of others wherever they live, and educate in a grounded scientific way, in a solutions way, their elected officials. So what are your thoughts on this general strategy, Tim? Having people teaming up with their elected officials to pass an ordinance against FCC's power grab, so retaining the right of siting in local government, and whatever legal process emerges as the most effective that cities are using that, in addition to cities actually taking steps to control and develop and build out the local infrastructure, the local wired fiber infrastructure to the building level. And let me just ask, for that building out, I guess a part B to that question is, and how would you recommend cities allocate funding to do that? So what do you think on the strategy first of like fighting legally, you know, Big Brother, and at the same time creating a roadmap for building out wired and safe solutions?
Well, the first issue, I think that, as I say, it just takes working, getting to know your local officials, your elected officials, first of all, and getting to know them, being able to go meet with them, have a cup of coffee with them, and don't assume that they're in the pocket of your opposition. Just be, you know, upfront with them and tell them how you feel, and make sure you have, you know, your friends do the same thing. Actually, I think they'll appreciate it. Don't assume that there's a conspiracy. Don't assume that everything is wired against you. Just assume that you just need to say it enough times so that they get the message. Keep in mind that they're very busy. Now, on the other issue, what was that? You were
like at the same time as, you know, taking a stand against the corporatized centralized control and for local, they actually are building out the solution, so creating the laying the groundwork for the wired solutions to the home and so forth.
Right, and one of the things is that it's well established that cities and towns put in, you know, sewer systems for their people, water systems, or, you know, in fact, that's been, you know, in some parts of the country, that's been, it's ironically, that's been a problem. You know, why can't we have clean water, drinking water for everybody? I mean, that's the most basic function of a town, you know, of a government. And so, you know, the next step somewhere along there is, one of the next steps is going to be getting internet access for everybody there. Now, unfortunately, while we were sleeping, I guess, you know, back in 2005, Alec went around and got at least 20 states to pass laws that prohibited localities, municipalities from building fiber networks or any kind of communication stuff. So in preference to corporations, private corporations, they got their agenda. Well, we have to undo that stuff. We can go back and get those laws abolished. They did the same thing recently with the small cells, but this was just about fiber, getting fiber networks. And so in Colorado, fortunately, there was an opt-out that cities could go. If they went to the ballot box, they could opt out of the damn thing. But these corporations will try to cement their monopolies if they can, and that's what they've done. Now, some of the states, you know, as I say, 20 states or so have that problem. The FCC actually overruled that. The old FCC overruled that, but then it got stopped in court. So there was a court battle, but the FCC was on the correct side of that issue in trying to get to enable broadband fiber in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and some of the other parts of I mentioned this in my paper. I described the whole battle, but that stuff has to be undone, and then communities, particularly communities that own their electric power system already, can do this very quickly. The national example, well, Chattanooga, Tennessee was an example of a municipal power system that then put in optical fiber network. And it was just, you know, a few years ago, it was state of the art. The new state of the art is Longmont, Colorado, which has the, you know, about a city of about 100,000 people that has probably 50,000 customers that have electricity and now potentially optical fiber. Then they can now move that system to an advanced distributed power grid if they want it. You know, the solar is catching on all over Colorado, and so we realized that what the crisis is here with the climate change issues and fossil fuels and pollution. I think it's just amazing what has happened just in the last year in terms of cities in Colorado adopting a 100% renewable energy goal for their community.
And laying the groundwork with these integrated, you know, fiber solutions like Longmont, was it? And having and basically laying the groundwork for them to take back their the control and take back their rights and actually protect their people at the same time from in the long term from these big corporate interests. So my question is, my next question is, do you see, have you identified a funding plan or like a roadmap that financially local governments can do this? They can assume the responsibility for building out. Like, how is it, how's it being done? What would you recommend to local officials?
Well, the cases that I just cited, I think Chattanooga ended up, was able to do it by because they got a large federal grant that helped them. They had to still provide a lot of the money, but they really got the thing going. And likewise, Longmont got some federal money to initiate that, and some of the rural electric associations that I know of in this region in Colorado and New Mexico got some funding to upgrade their, to put in optical fiber with their electric power systems. So, but the bottom line is that the municipality, municipalities have the power of taxation. They can do bonding, and an example is our neighboring town of Fort Collins, which decided that they've owned their own electric power system for some time. The problem is it's mostly based on coal, but they're trying to figure out how to transition that to solar. And they made the decision last year to do a bond authorization for about $150 million to build out optical fiber along with the electric power grid, so that they could then do the same thing Longmont did. Now, that's, you know, that's a bundle of money, but they it's not beyond their means. And it, the payback, it's been shown by, been in place a number of years in Chattanooga, and then it's too new in Longmont to have any statistics yet. But in Chattanooga, they were able to show that the return was $1 billion in the first of few years. In terms of local business, how it revitalized the entire economy of the city. And this, it can actually, you can see how having that kind of infrastructure could revitalize the local economy, particularly in an era when we're all going to, you know, the conventional ways of doing business and, you know, conventional work patterns of work and employment are changing to where there's more and more responsibility on individuals to, you know, fend for themselves or work at home or do, you know, what they call the gig economy or whatever, that communications becomes even more important than it ever was before. And that even the businesses work better if they have good communications. I think that kind of investment by communities in doing bonding to support a fiber construction would be paid off. Could pay off, but you know, each one has to take the courage to do that.
Yeah, and local governments also have the power to do. On the other hand, to make it more difficult for large, you know, the triopoly to take their zoning rights away, to take their deployment rights away. In other words, they can do things like recertification fees. And I know that on Environmental Health Trust website and Americans for Responsible Technologies, Telecom Power Grab, a couple of other websites, they're actually laying out, have you seen this, Tim, where they're laying out sample legislation, sample ordinances that issue recertification fees to the wireless providers to make it unprofitable or highly, you know, less profitable for them to deploy small cells everywhere. And secondly, they're passing ordinances to set minimum distances. So I think it was 1,500 feet, if I remember correctly, you know, as an example, minimum distance from cell sites and residential or, you know, school areas. Any thoughts on those, you know, those sets of powers that local governments do have?
Well, I think that's right. I've heard other people mention that. And I have to say, I don't know, I'm not completely up to speed on what those options are specifically, but I think that that's their responsibility to do things like that. The local government can and should do that to basically represent the interests of their citizens in controlling the rights of way. And environmental issues around that. The environmental issues are a tremendous responsibility.
Yeah, and then recently the California Supreme Court upheld its opinion, and it's either an opinion or a ruling, that basically affirming that in this case, San Francisco or any local government has more power than we've been told that it has, you know, in context of the 1996 Telecommunications Act. Like, there are different ways to interpret that, and that what seems to be emerging is that it's not entirely accurate to basically be under the opinion that local governments have no power because of that act, of Section 704 of that act. So that was actually upheld on the local government side just, you know, fairly recently in 2019 in California. So, okay, that being said, just moving towards wrapping up this really fascinating conversation, which we kind of covered the gamut here, and I'm really just interested in how you can bring powerfully bring solutions in several different areas at the same time, Tim. Thank you for that. I just want to kind of get your closing thoughts on what we're seeing here is the need that we've identified for local interests, local people, communities, together with their local governments to basically come together and take a stand individually and collectively at the local level and to create something new, right? Because if they don't, then the big powers just kind of continue that narrative, right? So, and just in closing, would you have any other suggestions or help the viewer to kind of encapsulate or frame the heart of the message here?
Well, I think the things you're pointing out are excellent things. That and one of the things that can be done to take advantage of that is of those things you mentioned is better communication between cities and towns. We have we've got some experience here in Boulder and in Colorado of cities learning to work together and collaborate and to trade these knowledge that they've gained and the solutions that they're, because they all share a lot of the common problems. A lot of their problems are unique to their community, but then a lot of them are not. And many, they have a lot of common solutions. And some of the stuff you just mentioned a few minutes ago is in the category of where sharing of information and experiences, and even sometimes legal costs, will make it easier to do and actually give them courage. So when they see that these aren't just, they're not just off by themselves having to fend for themselves, but they have colleagues next door that they can work together with in other communities. I think there are a number of those organizations forming around that focused on different topics, but that's a way to go, to learn what the landscape is for people, the local activists to learn what the landscape is and then make sure their public officials are aware of it.
My last question. Are you optimistic about the future? And if so, are there any other keys in order for the people to unlock that a positive future?
Well, I don't know. I have to be optimistic because I don't know what else to do. I guess it's part of my nature anyway. But the I think there's always a way. And one thing is look at every situation. One thing I learned early on as an entrepreneur is that look for the opportunity in every catastrophe. There may be some, or there usually is some other way to take advantage of it.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for joining us today on the summit. We encourage everyone out there to check out those two seminal works of Tim's, Getting Smarter About the Smart Grid and Reinventing Landlines and Wired Technologies. So, Tim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Josh.